Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to a February 19, 2009 segment from the Kentucky Water Fuel Museum. With us today is Greg Vesnia, who is chairman of Hydrofuel Incorporated. And let's see if Mr. Vesnia is not with us on the line. Hello, Mr. Vesnia. Mr. Vesnia, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Very good. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's Vezina, by the way, V-E-Z-I-N-A.
Oh, I-N-A. I'm sorry. I'll have to correct that on the website then.
Yep.
Vezina. Oh, very good. And Mr. Vezina, you are located in Ontario, Canada?
Yes, in Toronto, Canada.
In Toronto. Okay. And you are chairman of Hydrofuel Incorporated.
That's correct.
Now, how did you come to be involved in alternative fuel or energy technology? What is your history with regard to alternative energy?
Well, this goes back about 30 years when I first started a company, the precursor to this company called Canadian Alternative Energy Corporation. And we developed our first ammonia fuel conversion for a 1981 Chev Impala.
Very interesting. And this was in what year?
1981. If your listeners go to the website, nh3fuel.com, they can see a news item. That was run on CBC and CNN International that talks about the work that we did, 28 years ago and what we're doing now.
Very interesting. Now, how is it that you stumbled upon, or if that's what we want to use the word, stumble, but how did you come to view ammonia as a source of fuel?
Well, I like everyone else, I'm a bit of a student of history, and I know that hydrogen is the fuel of the future, and the quote from Jules Verne, et cetera. But I also knew that hydrogen was a very difficult fuel to store and handle by itself, because hydrogen doesn't like to be hydrogen; it likes to be hydrogen and something else. And so I was at a garage actually getting a car fixed, and I saw an article about Professor Jeff Kerr, a professor from the University of Tennessee, and he and his students had converted a four-cylinder BMW Metro to run on ammonia and entered it in the Green Challenge in '74 and came fifth. So I realized that ammonia was a fuel. In fact, ammonia is classified by the Society of Automotive Engineering, SAE, as a non-flammable automotive gas. So I took it from there.
Now, what does that mean, non-flammable automotive gas? Why would they classify it as that? Because of that, the work of the University of Tennessee, or?
No, ammonia was used as a fuel and in engines, and in fact in a solar cell application, as far back as about 1825. The first solar application was 1865. Ammonia was used long before hydrocarbons were used. And ammonia is classified as a non-flammable caustic gas because of the flammability limits. The flame range is very, very narrow. It takes a very specific amount of ammonia and air and a very, very high fat spark or ignition source, constant ignition source, to sustain combustion of ammonia. So it's not like gasoline or methanol or ethanol or virtually every other fuel where once you light the fuel will sustain combustion by itself. Ammonia is about 16 to 25% volume in air. And if you don't have that range and you don't have about 600 degree constant spark, ammonia won't burn. And that's one of the reasons that it's considered in all of the safety studies that have been done in Canada and in Europe, in fact, to be safer than all other fuels. You can get chemically burned and it can smother you, but it won't explode. And that's very, very important.
Very interesting. Now, when you talk about 1825, that's pretty astounding. I was totally unaware of the fact that somebody was coming up with a solar ammonia system back then. Where were they getting their ammonia at that time? How were they making it?
Well, ammonia's been made for hundreds of years. Ammonia back then was made from urea, you know, from waste. And in fact, there are plants under construction today to make it that way again. It's interesting that, you know, we take municipal or farm waste and we pay to dispose of it. Whereas some smart entrepreneur is going to figure out that you can take that waste and get paid to turn it into fuel.
Well, I know shoveling manure when I was 12 years old, I remembered smelling ammonia from the manure pile. The distinct odor of ammonia coming from, composting manure.
Yeah, it's part of the natural degradation process. Ammonia is about the fifth largest manufactured commodity on the planet. There's a lot of the stuff around. There's a 5,000-mile pipeline up the center of the United States. In fact, the U.S. DOE did a report 2 years ago on ammonia as a fuel, and the government itself said that you could fuel about 80% of the vehicles in 100 of the largest cities of the United States using the existing infrastructure. And you see, that's very important when you look at alternative fuels. Because ammonia is already used as an agricultural commodity, the difference is that the infrastructure is stored. The ammonia is stored for approximately 6 months and then emptied, you know, every 3 weeks, for over 3 weeks in the fall and the spring. So if the inventory becomes throughput, if you're using it as a transportation fuel, you don't have to store it as long, and you can use the existing infrastructure to store a lot more of it. An ammonia fuel station would cost, $15,000, $20,000, $25,000. A hydrogen fuel station will cost $1 million. Ammonia is already pipelined. It can be pipelined in existing gas systems. It's a low-pressure gas. Hydrogen, if you're going to pipeline it, it's very difficult because it leaks through the pipes and it causes metal embrittlement. And we've not had a hydrogen-powered Humvee get rear-ended yet. I think it's going to be real interesting what's going to happen if you have large amounts of hydrogen in the infrastructure and you have an accident. Because I and others who are aware of safety and handling have been expressing concerns about this mad rush to this miracle fuel that, in my opinion, is more of a nightmare than a miracle.
Well, the approach that the powers that be are taking with regard to hydrogen is not the sensible one, as you point out. It has to do with the current players in the energy scene selling compressed hydrogen to the public instead of the public using old technology that's been with us for decades to convert water to hydrogen on demand under the hood.
Well, that's correct, and you know, the fact of the matter is that Winston Churchill was right when he said two things. He said first, the first quote that I like is he said the Americans will do the right thing. Eventually, after they've tried everything else, which I think is true, America will get to the right place. The problem is that sometimes by the time you get there, there isn't anything left worth getting there for. But the second is that the further you look into the past, the further ahead you see into the future. And that's true with many, many, many technologies. We have the technology. We've had medical technology, for example, that was developed, low-level electrical stimulation by Tesla, 300-400 years ago, that's now being used in medicine for lymphatic drainage and et cetera, et cetera. We had ammonia as a fuel, assisted combustion or actually compression ignition or compression power in the 1800s. We had ammonia used as a solar cell in a bladder application on a farmhouse in 1865, where the farmer was able to use ammonia and sunlight to run a pump in his well and had running water in his house at 30 gallons per minute 150 years ago.
Yeah, elaborate on that example. Where was he located?
I'm actually not sure of the city, but the reference is under if anyone were to Google ammonia motors, there's a site up there by a gentleman named Donald Self, And he has references to the actual work up there.
The actual technology, though. What do you mean by a bladder on the roof?
Well, it was just a thin steel tank with ammonia. And in sunlight, of course, the sunlight would heat the metal and expand the ammonia gas, which would run a motor, run a pump. And with that pump in the well, he ran lines to his house, and he had running water in his house in 1865 at 30 gallons per minute. We have, you know, we don't have a lot more than that now. So it just goes to show that there are many, many examples of the technology has existed for many years to make us independent, make us free, and somehow we've managed to forget not to use it.
Well, and I think, too, it wasn't a matter of it having been well-known by the public and then forgotten. I think that the people who sell fuel have kept stories like the guy in 1865 and so on. They've kept those stories low-key in the press because it was a threat back then, and it continues to be a threat. So even though Jules Verne wrote what he did, he was watching the news more closely than the average person does, and that's how he was able to write about hydrogen being the fuel of the future when the average citizen wasn't really paying much attention to the existing technology. That he wasn't prophesying about something future. He was watching what was happening in the news, but it just wasn't being stressed, and he was the one to stress it in his fiction novels, you know.
Well, I would suggest that in fact the world, America, and the world does know that the technologies exist to solve a lot of the problems, and that quite frankly it's politics that prevents a lot of these solutions from happening, and I'm very pleased with the choice of the American people in the last election. Although I traditionally am a philosophically libertarian green, I'm a very conservative. Our conservative politics doesn't obey its philosophy and doesn't. Conservative means preserving what you have and working with what you have. Traditional Republicans and conservatives in Canada don't believe that anymore. They believe in giving grants and subsidies to oil companies to create pollution, or they believe in giving grants and subsidies to oil companies to bury carbon in the ground. They don't believe in developing alternative technologies or conservation. And a true conservative would, of course, support sound economics. And sound economics is that for every $1 million that you spend on the conventional energy sector, be that oil, gas, nuclear, if you spent that $1 million on conservation or renewables, you create five times the employment, 500% more jobs. So I'm not a big fan of traditional conservatives because they're not conservatives. So I'm very pleased with the choice of the voters in the United States who have elected a president, it appears, who gets it, who actually understands it, who actually remembers grade 3 science and grade 4 economics, who understands that for every dollar that you or every dollar that you spend outside of your economy importing oil, you can spend $10 in your economy creating energy or creating conservation, and you can create just as much economic opportunity by not giving away your country. So God bless America. You finally figured it out. Now why don't you get to work?
Well, do you see any evidence of the administration having got to work with the implementation of any of this?
Well, I mean, the man's only been president for a month. I'll give him a break. But I certainly believe that look, and when we're all human beings and we all make mistakes, and he is, after all, a politician, and he's dealing with a House and a Senate, he's dealing with a Congress that is trapped by the traditional influences. And you know, they're you know green to some of them is carbon sequestering. I don't believe that taking CO2 and pumping it into the ground and hoping that it's going to stay there and it's all going to be fine is maybe the answer. I think there might be other ways to sequester carbon, but we can go back to that. But there is an indication that the administration's approach is going to be that green is going to be making brown better, and brown mean hydrocarbon technology on the one hand. But on the other hand, I truly believe that the administration understands that green works, that there's huge employment opportunities and huge investment in economic opportunities for America to become a green world leader.
Yeah, I don't think that's been stressed very much in the news lately. Mostly what they've been stressing as some kind of economic recovery plan is to work on infrastructure, which I haven't heard the inclusion of green technology as part of the infrastructure enhancement program that they've included in their recovery program.
Well, I think in many cases you have to read between the lines. I mean, the U.S. government is looking at spending $1 trillion to upgrade the grid. If you go to distributed generation, for example, if you used ammonia as liquid electricity, because remember, ammonia and hydrogen are the only chemical currencies. They're the only things that allow you that can be made from electricity and turned back into electricity. No other hydrocarbon or no other form of energy is backward and forward compatible in that way. And they're starting to build wind-powered ammonia plants. They're starting to realize that there is huge economics and there is huge practical sense from an engineering and infrastructure point of view to take off-peak electricity and turn it into ammonia and ship the ammonia and turn the ammonia back into electricity.
Okay,
huge, huge, huge sense there. And so if you...
Before we go on, you mentioned a wind-powered ammonia generator. In layman's terms, how does such a device work?
Well, you take wind energy, which is wind electricity, wind power, and you make electricity in what's called stranded wind power sectors, which is places where you have high amounts of wind, but you don't have a ready market for the electricity. That's the same case. It's the same in the production of ammonia. Traditionally, ammonia has been made from oil, from coal, and from natural gas. And the cheapest ammonia in the world is that ammonia that's made in Trinidad and in Russia. That is made from what's called stranded natural gas, and that is natural gas that does not have a pipeline to a market. And so what they do is you make ammonia from stranded natural gas for a tenth of the price of making it from natural gas, you know, that's available in New York City. So what they do is they take the stranded energy in that natural gas and they turn it into ammonia. Well, it's the same thing with electricity. You could take but it's better to take stranded natural gas and make ammonia than it would be to make electricity to turn the electricity into ammonia. But the bottom line is you have, in many, many cases, you have around this world, you have a feedstock, whether it's solar energy or wind energy or garbage or waste or farm waste or animal waste, human waste. You have a feedstock that is not, in most cases, at a major population center. Municipal garbage is the exception, where there's a cost for that feedstock, and the feedstock stranded, the cost for that feedstock is much, much lower than the cost for that feedstock in an urban area. That feedstock can then be turned into ammonia, but you turn it into electricity first in most cases. That electricity can be stored in ammonia, turned into ammonia, and then turned back into electricity during peak demand periods, because you get 10 times as much revenue for electricity in peak periods than you do in off-peak. And it makes far more economic sense to ship electricity in ammonia in a pipeline than it does to ship electricity in a transmission grid, because of the losses and because of the construction costs and the maintenance costs.
Yeah, the ammonia that's produced in Trinidad, for example, I take it that it is transported in liquid form on a
ship. Yeah, well, ammonia is a at 100 degrees C is 200 psi. So all I do is if you put it in a pressurized vessel at 200 psi, it's a liquid. And so it's like a liquid in, vapor out. So what they do is they put liquid in the bottom of the tanker and vapor out the top, and they just suck the vapor off the top until the container is filled with liquid. Virtually the same as propane. And they ship it in barges, huge barges all over the world. But you can ship ammonia, as I say, on rail cars. You can ship it on tankers. You can ship it. It's very easy to store and handle it, and it's by and large very safe. In fact, the safety and handling of ammonia is recognized. The record is recognized as better than virtually any other commodity in the world. Yes, there's accidents. Yes, stuff happens. We live in a world where things go wrong. But by and large, if it's handled properly, it's extremely safe. If you have a spill of ammonia, because ammonia is lighter than air, unlike methanol, ethanol, diesel, gasoline, it does not pool in the ground and burn or blow up with one little spark. By the time, in most cases, when you have an ammonia spill, by the time the hazmat people get there, the hazardous materials guys get there, the ammonia's gone. So it's very safe to handle and safe to use. It's a very, very, very good chemical way to store electricity for demand use.
Okay,
and it's a very good way to eliminate the need to spend $1 trillion on an electrical grid, because of the losses of electricity in the lines in the grid, because of the construction costs of the grid, because grids are above ground, and because of the maintenance costs.
Okay.
Much, much more sense.
How is it that barge of ammonia from Trinidad gets turned into electricity once it arrives at a port?
Well, we don't do that yet. We don't do that in North America. We don't turn ammonia into electricity yet. But keep an eye on our website, because we filed some patents, and we will have an announcement of a new conversion system for all diesel and gas generators within about 90 days. We will be in Los Angeles, and we will be making an announcement. Essentially, all you do is you take a diesel generator or a natural gas generator, and you change some of the components to be compatible with ammonia. And instead of running them on diesel or oil or coal, you run them on ammonia. And if you go into the chemistry of ammonia, ammonia is has a much more efficient conversion number. Energy in to energy out. For some reason, God decided that ammonia worked better in internal combustion engines than any other fuel. So when you burn ammonia in air, you get about 120% net efficiency, 110% power output. For those of us that are science-based, and remember the X-15 rocket, the X-15 ran on oxygen and ammonia. It just so happens that if you burn ammonia in oxygen, you get 150% efficiency. So you can take a coal-fired plant, you can convert it to run on ammonia, you can come up with a source of oxygen that takes about 11% of the energy, and now your plant has about 140% power output over what it did with coal, and your plant has zero emissions, none, not a drop of anything, no nitrous oxides, no hydrocarbons, no carbon oxides, zero emission plant, which requires no scrubbers, no nothing, and you can build the thing beside school.
Wow.
And you can do it tomorrow.
That's amazing.
It is amazing. And the traditional approach to hydrogen, electrolysis of hydrogen, has been, why don't we electrolyze water and get hydrogen and we'll vent the oxygen into the atmosphere? To which I say, no, dummies, you missed it all. Why don't you vent the damn hydrogen into the atmosphere and use the oxygen for combustion so that you have total combustion? And even the good old oil companies and the coal companies have figured that out because they're now building a plant in Texas that uses ammonia to scrub CO2 out and burns coal in oxygen. So they're getting to the right place. They still haven't figured it out, and they're doing it for all the wrong reasons, but what the heck?
Well, they still want to sell their fossil fuel, and so they don't want to emphasize a technology that could actually replace it.
Well, what they don't understand is that there is a technology that's been around in the steel industry for 200 years. There is a way to take fossil fuels, to take the carbon out, to give the carbon to municipalities as building panels for free housing for Habitat for Humanity, and to just burn the hydrogen or ammonia. So there are technologies that exist, but it means that they have to work cooperatively with municipalities. It means that city councilors can't vote to give the garbage contract to someone who piles it in the ground and sticks in a pipe and takes the methane off and leaves everything else there. It means that municipalities have to give their garbage to someone that's going to totally recycle it 100%. And I expect there'll be some municipal elections in the next 5 years or so where city councilors will campaign in favor of giving their municipal waste to big garbage corporations who will leave it in the ground or to green entrepreneurs who will make it disappear and turn into housing. And we'll see which city councilors win.
Well, could be which ones live, because it seems that the certain mafias have taken over the garbage collection in the United States, and people who have defied them have actually ended up dead. So,
well, I know nothing about that because I'm fortunately a very smart man, and I'm up here in Canada, and I can plead stupidity when I feel it's necessary. That said, a business is business. And in the great spirit of capitalism, if you ask a capitalism to choose whether he would like half a loaf of regulated bread from a government or none, the capitalist will tell you none until the very last moment, and then he'll accept half. So money has no morals, my friend, and I think you will see that when the vested interests realize that there is more money in doing the right thing than the wrong thing, they'll do the right thing. You know, it's just like economics in America today. I mean, you do not have the direct subsidies to oil and gas exploration the way we do here, but you do have subsidies. And you do not have full cost accounting. You don't have the medical cost for urban pollution, healthcare costs, loss of productivity, social costs, added to the price of your oil or your gasoline or your electricity made from coal. And this is the thing that I look forward to from your new president, maybe not in the first term, but certainly by the end of the second. You will realize that user pay is not a bad philosophy. I don't think that we need regulations telling us what we can or cannot do. I think what we need is a regulator that says, here's the price of doing what you do, and we'll collect it. And in that way, nobody needs any government grants or subsidies. The green industry doesn't need government money to survive. What the green industry needs is a fair marketplace.
A level playing field.
A level playing field. And with full cost accounting, which includes, by the way, the labor and social costs, that's very important to include the labor and social costs. It's very important to include the trade deficit costs. what's happening to my economy because I'm sending all my money out of my economy to someone else who then come back and buys my industries for 10 cents on the dollar because I bankrupted myself. And so I think that you know, as the Japanese warrior said at Pearl Harbor, I fear we've made a grave mistake. We've awakened the sleeping giant. I think the sleeping giant of America is about to wake up. And I think if you do, and not if you do, when you do, then this world 10 years later will be a very, 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 very different place. And so I say, God bless America.
I'm thinking more in terms of the immediate practical application of your ammonia technology than I am hopes of some great recovery for any political system that humans have propped up on false premises. But
there's nothing more motivating than follow the leader, right? So I mean, we're going to have three products available in April. We're going to have our retrofit available for gasoline or diesel conversions of vehicles to run on dual fuels, either diesel ammonia or gasoline ammonia. And that product will be demonstrated, university lab tested, and demonstrated in April and available this year.
So we're talking about a tank of liquid ammonia on board or gaseous ammonia?
Well, it's liquid ammonia because it's under pressure.
Okay.
And when you open the valve... When you open the valve, it turns into a gas, a vapor. There are liquid ammonia. There are liquid like liquid propane fuel systems, and we are working with one manufacturer who builds those to make a liquid ammonia fuel system. But the systems that we're going to release first are going to be vapor, which run on ammonia vapor.
So I'm a bit familiar with that because of working with propane and small engines.
Right.
And it seems that a gas grill tank, for instance, draws the propane gas off of the top of the tank, I suppose, whereas a liquid ammonia tank or a liquid LP gas such as is used on a forklift, because it has a higher fuel requirement than a small engine, it'll draw off of the bottom of the tank.
Yeah, in fact, all they do is turn the tank upside down. But anyway, yeah. All they do is all I use is gravity. It's what they call a gravity feed. But we're going to release a vapor based system first. But it really doesn't matter. Ammonia will flow freely up to about minus 30 degrees Celsius. And then it won't flow under its own pressure. So all you do is put a little block heater in the side of the tank, and like a glow plug thing, and you just warm it up a little bit, and it'll still flow. In fact, ammonia is a real beautiful fuel for Arctic and subarctic applications where they can't get diesel to run at all because diesel turns into molasses. But the whole idea is to release a retrofit conversion. The provisional patents we filed, and we have more patents that are being filed now, so I have to kind of be careful about what I say, but generally speaking, the whole idea is for people to be able to run vehicles that run on propane or LPG as a universal fuel. So with the modifications and the new fuel tanks we'll be selling, you will be able to run your propane vehicle on propane or ammonia or a mixture or blend of both or neither. And the technology that we own and the software that we own for our own fuel controllers and our own fuel maps will allow you to basically run a universal fuel. So you'll be able to put any fuel in this system, whether it's a gas or a liquid, any combination, any blend of any fuel, and it'll run.
So you're referring then to the modern vehicles, computer controlled fuel injection systems and whatnot.
Yes, well, that's exactly what we've done. Is we built our own software and our own controller that just plugs into the existing ECUs in vehicles.
It's an interface, or it how is it actually connecting to the ECU?
We just plug right into the electrical wiring harnesses. We plug right into the plugs.
So
we have our own controller. We built and designed our own electronic fuel controller and our own maps and our own beds.
Very interesting.
And it'll be an add-on. It'll be a retrofit. So you'll be able to add this to virtually any electronically controlled system. We also have a manual system that will work with all of the old IMCO carburation parts. So virtually any system that runs on propane or CNG, you'll be able to use our components to make them run on that fuel and ammonia. And the ammonia tanks, the fuel tanks, the propane tanks, you can't use ammonia in a propane tank because of materials compatibility problems, because of metal embrittlement, which is the problem you have with hydrogen. The secret to ammonia is all you do is anneal the tank, which is superheated, take out the hairline cracks and fractures. So you're going to be able to switch off your propane tanks for one of our ammonia propane natural gas tanks, and you'll have a tank that will hold any fuel at any time.
Well, now, speaking of these kinds of components, what is the approximate cost? Or you've probably come up with a figure of an approximate cost.
Depends on the application, but we're looking at somewhere between $6,000 and $8,000 U.S.
And that would be to convert an existing vehicle to an ammonia-powered vehicle?
Yes. Well, that's to convert them to multi-fuels.
Okay.
We're looking at ammonia, excuse me, retailing for about half the price of gasoline.
And yet being 140 or 150% more efficient.
Well, no, because that's a different technology. That's ammonia and oxygen.
Okay.
I'm talking about burning ammonia in air right now. Because you're not going to have an onboard oxygen generator. That's not included in this particular version of the technology. That's coming.
And so what's the efficiency of burning ammonia in air then?
You get about 120% net efficiency, and you get 110% net power output. And there's no carbon in the fuel, remember, if you burn pure ammonia. And so there's no carbon acids in the engine, very little oil viscosity breakdown. So that you expect, no carbon crowning of your pistons, no scoring of the cylinder walls, etc. So you can expect a greatly enhanced engine life and very, very, very little maintenance on an ammonia-based engine.
Now, is that good?
That's very good. That's very, very good.
A former Miss America asked me that when I told her it's possible to turn water into fuel. She said, is that good?
Yeah, well, I'm not touching that one either.
I don't think the automakers would be happy to hear that statement.
No, I disagree with that. In fact, I disagree with a lot of the knocks against the automakers. I think a lot of this is a lot of the knocks against the automakers is revisionary history. If the consumers demanded ammonia vehicles, the automakers would build them.
Yes. Now, what would be the cost for the automaker to include an ammonia system?
OEM, probably half of that. I know that the Roush liquid propane injection system that comes OEM on the Ford 150, the F-150 pickup truck, is built by ICOM, North American ICOM Italy. And ICOM is the same manufacturer that we're working with for our liquid injection ammonia system. So everything that we use, made out of slightly different materials, already comes factory equipped on the F-150. So it wouldn't be a big deal for Ford to give me a call and say, oh, by the way, can we get this system that we built compatible for propane with Roush Engineering, can we get it compatible for propane, ammonia, natural gas, and everything else from you? I'd sell it to them.
Yeah, and what is the additional cost on that F-150 coming with a propane system?
It's about $10,000.
Additional?
Yes.
Okay.
But it is a we're talking about Roush people here. No, we're talking about, a well-known, highly respected American engineering and racing company. who's working with ICOM, which is a well-known international gaseous fuel company, carburation company, essentially. These are very, very highly respected companies, and the efficiencies and the cost per mile of operating that truck make that $10,000 investment recoverable very, very quickly. And remember, propane in the United States is about 80% of the cost of gasoline.
Right.
So you're saving 20%, and I think that system is probably benched out at about 110% net efficiency over hydrocarbons on a similar engine platform. So I think their numbers are probably their net overall operating efficiencies are probably about a 25% increase over conventional fuels.
And then the lower cost fuel, with
the lower cost fuel. So I think that you'll probably the payback period. I haven't done the economics on this for propane because I do it on ammonia. But the payback period for the same system on ammonia would be in a commercial vehicle 2 years. In 2 years, you'd pay for the vehicle. Pay for the conversion. We have other products coming out. We've built a vehicle to grid generator, and this is an electrical generator that bolts on to the transmission of trucks, pickup trucks, and all trucks. And manual trucks have two, and automatic trucks have one. And this generates electricity off the engine of the vehicle when the vehicle is parked. And so that you take your vehicle to work, and where you're at work, or take it to the mall, or take it to the hospital, or take it wherever you're going, and where you're going, you need electricity, so you plug your vehicle into the grid wherever you take it, and you generate electricity, and if you do nothing but generate peak power for distributed generation, you will own your vehicle in 3 years completely. The revenue that it will generate for you will pay for the vehicle entirely in about 3 years.
Yeah, and we're assuming that the utility companies would welcome this kind of contribution.
Well, the experience in other countries has been that the utility companies have obviously resisted this kind of contribution because they lose control over generation. But then the politicians started getting the bills for building a new grid. And when the politicians realized that they were going to have to raise taxes by 50% to allow less than generous utilities to control generation, and yet if they let all flowers bloom, that they didn't have to raise taxes at all, but they could reduce taxes, for some reason the politicians passed laws telling utilities, open up the system. I don't know if that'll happen in America. I don't know if President Obama is going to use $1 trillion of taxpayers' money to protect utilities and double taxes when he can pass a simple piece of legislation that says you will have access to the grid for green products at this price. I know that in the province of Ontario, Canada, we had a law stating that they have to give you access to the grid, and we have a new law that sets how much money they have to pay you per kilowatt, peak and off-peak. And our new law says that the utility has to connect you with the grid within 90 days of your application, or the utility has to pay you damages equal to all of your profits. There's also a thing in North America called the North American Free Trade Agreement. You've not had a Canadian or a Mexican company ask the FTA panel for $1 trillion, please, because America won't let me into its marketplace. But I expect that someone's going to do it. I guarantee you someone is going to do it.
Huh.
And I can tell you the name of the law professor who's going to bring the case.
So that was one of the conditions of NAFTA?
Oh, one of the conditions of NAFTA is that you cannot arbitrarily interfere with me doing business in your marketplace unless you're using one of the exemptions. And if you do, you have to pay me the profits I would have earned. And I don't even have to make the investment. And of course, one of the exemptions in NAFTA is environmental. Well, you can't subsidize oil and coal and prevent green technologies from entering the marketplace because I'm using the NAFTA provisions to destroy America. I'm, to be honest, very, very surprised that some enterprising entrepreneur in the United States and the environmental movement in the United States has not got together and brought a massive NAFTA claim against all government subsidies and incentives to brown technology. I think Robert Kennedy Jr. and his friends are asleep because the biggest hammer in the world is greed. Well, no, the biggest hammer in the world is fear of loss, of which greed is a component. But you've had the tools in the United States, and we've had them here in Canada and Mexico since 1984 to change all of this. And the problem, I think, is that many, many environmentalists are too busy complaining about the problems to actually deal with solutions. A lot of them don't like solutions because if you have a solution, then you don't have a problem anymore, and then they have to go get a job.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. There are people who are, I mean, there are vested interests on both sides of the fence.
Right.
And
now, I believe in just knocking the fence down, letting the cows range free, eh?
Yeah.
I figure if you mix the environmentalists with the capitalists and let them get together in the same tea party, they'll realize that up until now they've been drinking the same hemlock. So, because I think if you look at things in a practical way, you'll realize that their interests are exactly the same. They're going to end up in exactly the same place. They're just taking two very long routes to get there. So, the second generation of products that we're going to produce this year, and we're going to be testing a prototype and announcing it, is the vehicle to grid generator. So now you'll be in a position where, and this generator will actually work on any internal combustion engine. It doesn't have to be ammonia. But now you'll be in a position where you can generate electricity wherever you go, and generally wherever you go, there's an increased need for electricity. So that'll mean that maybe the U.S. government doesn't have to spend $1 trillion building a new grid. And in grid costs, the highest or most expensive electricity is what's called the last mile. And that is the electricity, for example, to a pig farm. They don't have pig farms in the middle of cities. So the grid cost to get electricity into these remote rural areas is humongous. And that same pig farm pays someone to take away that farm waste. Professor Jerry Botte at University of Ohio has done some research and filed a number of patents on a low-level electrolysis technology to turn animal waste into ammonia. So you can take the animal waste at that pig farm, turn it into ammonia, make the electricity that pig farm uses from its own waste, and sell peak electricity onto the grid. Or use the peak electricity, use the ammonia, and ship the ammonia to be used as electricity or fertilizer, which means you don't have to have power lines to that pig farm anymore. And that's the whole approach to distributed generation.
Yeah.
Don't ship electricity.
Now, why don't we go back to the actual mechanics of firing ammonia in our existing internal combustion engine. So you're saying that with a propane carburation or modified propane carburation, you can get the fuel into the engine, and I suppose that with fuel injectors, you would need to change the injector opening time, or actually change the whole injector, I suppose, to a gaseous fuel injector. Is that the idea?
Well, it depends. It depends on the application. It depends whether you're going with liquid fuel, whether you're going with vapor. It depends whether you're going with dual fuel or single fuel. But let's say it this way, because I don't want to complicate it. There are according to the National Research Council of Canada, who studied ammonia as a fuel, there are no practical or technical engineering difficulties that are not very logically solvable and extremely low cost for the widespread use of ammonia as an internal combustion engine fuel.
Right, because okay. They're already making injectors for natural gas and other fuels.
Exactly. I mean, the worst problem that you have in most cases is what's called materials compatibility. Ammonia does not work with brass or copper materials. It's like taking a pound of butter and heating a knife. You get ammonia and brass or copper, and it will eat through it in a matter of minutes. So as long as you change your materials, that's generally about half the battle. The second thing you have to do is you have to be aware, you know, a little bit of mechanical engineering and a little bit of knowledge of chemical properties. So, you know, you have to know that ammonia burns at 16 to 25% in air. You have to know that it likes, say, a 600-degree constant spark. You have to know that if the spark doesn't stay there, that the ammonia won't sustain combustion by itself. If you're going to do a diesel generator, you have to know the difference between spark ignition and compression ignition of ammonia, and so on. So there is nothing here that a smart grade 9 student can't figure out.
Okay, so if someone wanted to do a simple science fair project showing ammonia burning in, say, a lawnmower engine, can they do it? Is it possible to?
I haven't worked with a lawnmower engine. It's a two-stroke as opposed to a four-stroke. It's a single cylinder. As long as you could naturally aspirate the fuel, as long as you could control the fuel-to-air mixture properly, and as long as you could create a fat enough spark, sure you could do it.
Okay. So
but, I mean, you know, ammonia has been used as a fuel for many, many, many years. I mean, in 1933, Norsk Hydro in Belgium, or sorry, in Norway, built an ammonia-powered truck. In 1944, during the Nazi occupation of Belgium, they converted several thousand buses to run on ammonia for the duration of the war because they had no diesel fuel. The U.S. military did a lot of work on ammonia in the early 1960s on the Energy Depot project, which was headed by a gentleman named Vito Augusto. Professor Jeff Kerr did the work that he did in 1974, and of course we've done the work that we did in the past and we're doing now. And you also have a company in Iowa in the United States called the Hydrogen Engine Center that is working on what they call an aux power generator, which is an ammonia propane based engine that they're using for irrigation pumps. So, I mean, ammonia, it's not new. We're not talking rocket science anymore here.
I saw a Popular Mechanics or Popular Science article from 1930, thereabouts, that showed an ammonia refrigeration system for a home that did not use any power at all. It
was yes.
A steel ball, a metal ball outside the wall of the home facing the sun, I suppose. And when the sun heated up that ball, the ammonia then transferred, you know, expanded and went to the inside of the home where it formed ice.
Yes, well, ammonia is the best refrigerant there is. In fact, one of the patents that we'll file in a year or two, I'm too busy working on these other things right now, but I've spoke to engineers at the National Research Council here in Canada. I have a really good idea for using ammonia in the center column of all housing construction, where the ammonia would be used for heating, air conditioning, and for power generation. For electrical generation, grid storage, and everything, where you could use one source of ammonia. And as long as all of the, you have complete water recovery of gray water as well as black water, as long as all of the fixtures in the building came off a center column where you had your ammonia chamber, you could even break open the ammonia tank within the house. And no one would be harmed, and a valve would open, and the ammonia being lighter than air would just float into the sky. So there are clearly some amazing applications for ammonia in the housing industry. And in industrial applications, we're looking at a very, very interesting application right now for use with ammonia with hospitals and large apartment buildings.
So in other words, the hype about ammonia being dangerous in a residential application, do you think that that's similar to what is called the Hindenburg mentality with regard?
Yes, yes. Let me just say this in the most politest and crudest of terms: bullshit. Absolute bullshit. Ammonia is far safer than any other fuel, any other combustion chemical known to man.
So, do you think this has been a deliberate attempt to turn the public off to something that is obviously superior when it comes to all these different ways of powering our world?
Well, I don't think that most business people and most news people even have a clue that ammonia is a fuel for them to be smart enough to build a conspiracy around it. And I will say that maybe part of the knock on ammonia has come from the materials handling industry that wants ammonia to be handled the way it is in Australia. In Australia, they have this amazing thing. Somebody went before the legislature and so scared all the politicians over there about how bad ammonia was that farmers are not allowed to drive ammonia down the side of a road in a nurse tank to use for fertilizer. And the government regulated it so only industry can handle and store ammonia. So ammonia that a couple of years ago sold in the United States for $200 or $300 or $400 a metric ton is $1,000 a metric ton in Australia because ammonia is so scary.
Yeah.
So I guess what I'm suggesting is that part of the problem may be that there are those that would like ammonia to be very scary so that they can make a great deal of money controlling the handling and storage side of the business. But if you look at the ammonia safety issues, if you go to the Ammonia Fuel Network on the internet, AFN, they have a website, and they have through the Beacon site, they have a annual conferences. And if you look at the safety in handling ammonia, I mean, you can stand beside ammonia spill and take virtually a rubber sheet and pull it over top of yourself, a plastic sheet. And because the ammonia is lighter than air, the ammonia will dissipate and you won't be harmed. I dare you to break open a propane tank and light a smoke.
Yeah.
You know? So the fact of the matter is ammonia is if you know it, if you handle it properly, and if you are prepared for a catastrophic accident, even in a catastrophic failure of ammonia handling equipment, death is not certain. In the catastrophic failure of a propane, a natural gas, a gasoline, a diesel, an ethanol, a methanol, or a hydrogen system, death is guaranteed.
Yeah, we have enough statistical evidence to support that.
Death is absolutely guaranteed and assured in catastrophic failure. With ammonia, death is only a possibility, and that's assuming that the catastrophic failure doesn't kill you, right? Like your car gets driven over by a cement truck.
Right.
Well, the cement truck driving over you is the thing that kills you. But if you survive that, and you're fueled on ammonia, even if you're unconscious, the ammonia will wake you up. So, you know, like, hello.
Well, very interesting. Now, why don't we mention your website?
Yeah, the easiest link to the website is nh3fuel.com.
Okay. And the name of the company, again, is HydroFuel Incorporated.
Yeah, HydroFuel Inc., Canada to U.S., and we just opened an Australian office because I want to get in on some of that 1,000-gallon a ton ammonia, you know?
Yeah. Well, very well. It's been nice chatting with you, and hopefully we'll be able to do a follow-up interview in the near future.
Anytime. You know where to find me. Ammonia rocks, boys and girls. Thanks for having me.
Very good. Thank you, and
okay.
Have a good evening.
Okay. Bye-bye.